Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Thanks for joining me one more time. Up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and of course, find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to have you joining me one more time on this broadcast. You know, even though it's a podcast, technically, it's still broadcasting to me. I've been sitting behind a microphone for 25 years and on a lot of different places and locations and studios. And so now my office doubles as a studio. It's kind of cool. I don't have to drive anywhere to get behind a microphone at all. It's right here in front of me. And I was thinking about that early this morning because it is early this morning. It's still dark out. I've already had something to eat, got my coffee going, good to go. And typically Saturday morning is the time that I get ready to do the podcast as I look back on my week and the things that have been going on and try to surmise a little bit and improvise all the time to get something out into the world that I think could have some value. And as I mentioned, when I opened the show, as I've done every show, it's all about finding the obvious buried in the absurd and trying to make sense out of the senseless in a world that increasingly seems to be senseless. If you watch the news enough, you'll probably pick up on that. But my office has gotten increasingly crowded the last week or two because I rolled out all the Christmas stuff. And so when I'm working in here, I like to have some of my Christmas things around me for, oh, Jesus, I don't know, 20, 30 years. I collected Santa Clauses of all types, shapes, and sizes. And I finally jettisoned most of the Santas over to my son who lives in Upper Michigan. He's got a home there. He can fill his house with Santa Clauses. I don't know if he wants to, but it's up to him to handle the Santa duties at this point. But I do have a few things in here that just remind me of the time of year. I do have two Santas. I got a little Santa Claus that's like he's got his pipe out. It's like a little mug kind of thing. I've never used it except for a display. And then I have another ancient Santa Claus from the 50s that's the same kind of Santa Claus that I grew up with and had with me next to me for a long time. And then there's this little, I don't even know what you call these things. You know, it's a ceramic model, and it's of a log home type deal with trees around it. You know, it's like a Redlin who used to do a lot of paintings. I think they took Terry Redlin's paintings and made them into ceramics, and you put a battery in there, and the lights turn on. And I got to tell you, there's a little snowman out front, and it's as Norman Rockwellian as you can get. But those are the reminders that I have when I'm going into this season. And this little ceramic house is such an interesting little focal point for me. And I think, well, I know for me, in the days that we live in now, what you focus on expands. And so if you're sitting there watching the news all the time and you're on constant alert with all this stuff, you know, then it's a shit show. I refuse to participate in that because it's always been a shit show. I've talked about this in many shows and podcasts and broadcasts over the years, that it's all about perspective. So my perspective has me focused a couple times a day. And right now the little lights are on and the snowman's out front, and it's never ever changing for me. It just stays the way it is. And it's a little anchor for me at this time of year, as is the subject of this podcast, along with a couple other things woven in. But this is the time of year, especially early in the morning, like it is today on this Saturday, that I get up and I watch the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol with the great Alistair Sim. Now, as soon as I say Christmas Carol and I mention Alistair Sim, there's always arguing over who the best Ebenezer Scrooge was on television or in the movies. They've all done a great job. I'm not going to get into all that because there are literally forums on the internet where people are arguing, kind of missing the point of the whole Christmas Carol thing, over who's the best Scrooge. So for me, it's Alistair Sim. It was in 1951, and I have this vivid, vivid, vivid memory. I was probably 10, 11, 12 years old, something like that, and living in the big house on Berto Avenue, at one point my dad bought a Sears portable television. Now, for those of you listening to this show that are of a certain vintage, right, you can recall a time that if you had a television, it was a big deal. But to have two or three TVs was like you're the Clampets on Beverly Hills. You got money coming out your ass. So we did not have money coming out our backside. But my dad came across this portable Sears TV with a little handle on top and the antenna, you can move it from room to room and plug it in and watch television. It was, you know, unbelievable technology at its time. Little black and white TV. And I have this memory, as I mentioned, of a very cold, I mean, a prototypical Christmas in Chicago. This would have been in 1968, 970, somewhere in there. And ensconced in my room, locked down in my room, and I had that little TV plugged into the corner, and it was probably Family Classics. For those of you from Chicago, we remember Family Classics with Frasier Thomas as was the host of this, and they would show movies all the time and things like that. And Thomas would, you know, in between talk about the show and stuff. So I'm pretty sure that's where I saw this 1951 version of the Christmas Carol with Alistair Sim, and I was captivated by his performance. I was captivated by the messaging. It just, you know, it's one of those times where something gets in you at the right moment for the right reason, right on time. And it's never left me. And it's like this little ceramic house I have here with the lights on. I may post that on my Facebook page. We'll see. But it's a comforting thing to me. And it's also a perspective shifting thing for me. Because if you go back to when the book was actually written, you know, when Charles Dickens actually wrote the book, it was published in 1843. It's like 177 years ago. The illustrator was a gentleman named John Leech. And of course, A Christmas Carol recounted the story of Ebenezer Scrooge, this elderly miser who is visited by ghosts of his former business partner, Jacob Marley, in the spirits of Christmas past, present, and yet to come. And of course, after their visit, Scrooge is transformed into a better human being. Interesting to note that Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol during a period when the British were exploring and reevaluating Christmas traditions, including carols and newer customs such as Christmas cards and Christmas trees. What we have now that we take for granted is, I'm thinking to myself, could Charles Dickens have ever imagined what we call an e-card? You know, you just press a button, you get email, and there's a Christmas card there. But Dickens was influenced by the experiences of his own youth and the Christmas stories of other authors, including the great Washington Irving and others. And he had written three Christmas stories prior to this novella. So for those of you who are not familiar, a novel is of a certain length, but a novella is a much shorter length. That's why it's like a mini novel. It's called a novella. And he was inspired to write this book after a visit to the Field Lane Ragged School, one of several establishments for London's street children. The treatment of the poor and the ability of a selfish man to redeem himself by transforming into a more sympathetic character are the key themes of the story. And there's a lot of discussion over the years by academics and those who are really smart as to whether this is a fully secular story or if it's a Christian allegory. My point is, who gives a shit which one it is? If you become a better person, if you can be reminded of that, then don't argue over those two things, but that's how humans are. It was published, this is Saturday, December 18th. It was published December 19th. So tomorrow, on Sunday, December 19th, the first edition sold out on Christmas Eve, 177 years ago. Sold out. By the end of 1844, 13 editions had been released. Most critics reviewed the novella favorably. The story was copied illicitly and illegally in January of 1840, and Dickens had to take legal actions against the publishers, who then went bankrupt, further reducing Dickens' small profits from the publication. He went on to write four other Christmas stories in later years, and he began public readings of the story, which were so successful, he just undertook more stage adaptations and all that type of thing. This is one of the few books in the world that has never been out of print for almost 200 years and has been translated into several languages. And the story has been adapted, I mean, countless times, as I mentioned, for film, stage, opera, and other media. And it really captured the imagery and the stance and the personality, I guess you could say, of the mid-Victorian revival of Christmas holiday. There was a time, it's not what it is now. And so he was able to capture that and kind of bring it back a little bit. He acknowledged the influence of the modern Western observance of Christmas and later inspired several aspects of Christmas, including family gatherings and seasonal food and drink and dancing and being festive and all that type of stuff. So it's an incredible piece of work. And I've read it 25 times in my lifetime. And every time I read it, I am amazed. As an author myself and as a writer and one who coaches other people to write that have a story to tell, I'm amazed. First of all, it's written in different language. I mean, it's been upgraded, but if you read the original 1844 to 1848 versions of the book, you know, the wording they used and the verbiage was different and how it's put out. But it's amazing to me how simple it is. And I think that's one thing that has always stuck with me as a writer, is it doesn't have to be War and Peace. It doesn't have to be over the top. Some of my most influential authors are like John Steinbeck, who, you know, his books were very plainly written with deep, deep, heavy themes. And I think remembering that when I write is always paramount to me, that I don't, you know, I have some people that I work with that are incredible writers. I'm working with a woman now who we're doing the audio of her book, and that'll come out at probably early part of next year. And this is a book she wrote in 2013, and I've never read it. So I'm listening along as she's doing the audio for the book. And I'm captivated by the way she writes. Fascinating to me. I don't have that kind of leverage and toolbox when I write. So everybody has their own way. But suffice to say that this book made an impact on millions and millions of people over the years. This Dickens thing has become a standard part of Christmas. And so this is the time of year where I watch that, my favorite version of the Christmas Carol. It's usually about a week before Christmas, before it all kind of gets chaotic. And I just sit here early in the morning and I put it in the DVD player and I grab some coffee and something to eat. And I watch it again and again and again. And part of me feels like I did 1968, 1970s, whatever that time frame was. And that's a good thing. I'm reminded what it feels like to be 9, 10, or 11 years old, even though I'll be 63. Those things, I think, to me at least, are important. That core, that center, that part of me that deeply wants to see the world become a better place is affected by this film. And the guy, Alistair Sim, was a top-notch, coveted, highly respected actor. And while Scrooge is his probably most noteworthy performance, he was renowned for many different pieces of work. So watching him go through the transformation from the miserly Scrooge, who was as hard on himself as he was on other people, which is usually how it works, right? People who are in a lot of pain themselves usually pass it on to other people, becomes compound interest of the worst kind. And so you all know the story. I'm going to play, actually, I have just a little bit of audio I'm going to play a little bit later before we wrap this up, you know, that I think is just indicative of why it's so important in these times, in the 21st century, almost 200 years later, since Dickens wrote this, to remember that when he wrote this, people that were alive then thought it was a shit show. And here we are all these years later, with more technology at our fingertips than any other group of humans have ever had, and we think it's still a shit show. So perspective is really important in all of this to me. And when he goes through the steps that he has to go through, the Christmas past and the present and the future, and deal with all those spirits of what was and what is and what's to come if he doesn't change, that is a universal theme that does not lapse over time, obviously. So when I watch it now, I also think of how things are today. You can find Ebenezer Scrooges everywhere. This didn't end with the book, you know, being put out, you know, 177 years ago. It just was capturing how people were then, and people haven't changed a whole lot, unfortunately. However, in my own lifetime, I've seen some people go from Scrooge to a better man. And it is a rare thing, but it is something that's possible. So the transformational piece of this is not fiction. I mean, it was fiction when he wrote it, but it really does happen for people. And I think for me personally, I was never a Scrooge. I mean, there are days, I have my days like everybody else where I am Scrooge-like, I suppose. But over time, I've worked diligently to have the consciousness and the awareness to offset that as soon as I can. And I have found, as I've mentioned on this show numerous, numerous times, that if there's something in the world, some sort of malady in the world, something that needs help, you don't just sit back and go, look what they're not doing. Look what needs to be done, but they're not doing it, whoever they are. You actively get involved at the level you can yourself. And then you become so wrapped up and busy in being the solution, you don't have time to sit and worry about the problem and point out what somebody else isn't doing. Facebook has a lot of ups and downs to it to me. It's got pros and cons, good and bad. On one hand, it's like everybody's throwing up and they're in a constant, and you're like going to get rid of the puke all the time and find something that has value. But it's also a core sampling, I think, of human behavior. I see people who I have never met personally laying out their entire life for the world to see. And I'm thinking, I don't have those. I mean, what? Personal problems. But I also realized that maybe the only way they have to reach people is through this medium. So it's a very interesting to watch all this. But I find the posts that are most fascinating is somebody will put something up and say, for example, veterans need to be treated differently or better. Why isn't somebody doing something about it? My question is, why aren't you? One little drop in the bucket makes a difference at the point where you meet that problem. Or somebody says, we need more people like fill in the blank. I don't care who they are. Some great person who's done great things in the world that made positive change and brought out positive results. We need somebody like that. I'm saying, why isn't it you? Why aren't you stepping up into that? You think just because they could sing songs or act in movies or write books or get up on stage that they're any better than you are? That life meets you at that point. That instead of complaining about we need this type of person, then you become that person. If that person made such an impact that you think that with them gone, the world is a lesser place, then should you not step up into it? And to me, that's part of what this movie's all about. So thinking on all those type of things, this book that I'm working on is called Mapping a New Reality. It'll be out, like I said, it's already been out since 2013. You can find the print version all over. But the audio version, when you read a book, when you read writing, I'd love to have heard Charles Dickens do the audible version of his own book. That would have been just something else. I'm sure it's out there and a lot of great people have read it. But when you bring your voice to the words that you've written, something changes. I'm here to tell you. My latest book, Phenomenon, came out in 2020. It's on Audible. You can get it on Audible. Print is great. I have a bunch of copies on my shelf. I've sent them out for Christmas presents and people have bought them as gifts and I sign them. But there's something about that human voice being put to words that changes everything. So we're working on this book, Mapping a New Reality. Therese Raleigh, PhD, is the author. And one of the things that she points out, among many great points, is that, as I said a little bit before, we are not set up as a species to handle the technology we've created. We are kind of devaluing our own existence with all the value of this great technology. And as Bucky Fuller said, maybe even better, it's obvious. Now, he said this a half a century ago. It's obvious our technology is surpassing our humanity. So every time there was apparently something on TikTok, which I have known nothing about, to me, that's still a clock. You want TikTok? It's a clock. There was a threat made at a school and it's running around TikTok and I got to go find out. And all that is just another platform to be people to be stupid. And people have been stupid since day one or day four, maybe. So these platforms are neither good nor bad to me. It's what we do with them. But yet the inundation of the information, we were never set up and have not adapted to, in my observation, opinion, and experience, this download of information constantly saturating our central nervous system has us in a constant fight or flight mode. You know, back in the day, whatever day that was, there were four channels that we could access on TV, 2, 5, 7, and 9. I could get 11, but who would want to watch that? It was PBS back then, probably in the 60s and 70s, even though Sesame Street was on. Don't send any hate mail. And every now and again on Friday night, we could get channel 32 or 44 on the UHF dial. And that was really about the extent. And you get the newspaper at the end of the day or in the morning. That was it. There was not news on from 4 to 10 a.m. in the morning. There wasn't anything called a 24-hour news station. We certainly didn't have any devices that would constantly download the latest breaking horrible news right to our phones because the phones were on a frickin' wall. So in the span of my lifetime, I can see how many changes have taken place, but it really isn't. I just am not convinced that we're any worse as a species. It's just that it seems that way because it's everywhere. You know, go back in history and go back to the year I started watching this, go back to 68 or 69 and just read what was going on in the news. It was horrible. You know, RFK had been assassinated in 68. Martin Luther King Jr. assassinated in 68. We had the riots in Chicago in 68. You know, 1969, Vietnam was raging. The Cubs lost their chance to go to the World Series. It was freaking horrible. But you, just as much as I think the Christmas Carol is a core sampling of what life was like in that era, way back in 177 years ago, so are these things core samplings of our world now. I mean, there are some things that are definitely different. The environmental stuff, whether you believe it or not, doesn't matter to me. I do. And I think it's the height of arrogance to think that we live in this biosphere and we couldn't somehow damage it because we're what? Only human? I call BS on that. And I keep hitting my microphone, so I'm getting pretty animated on this end. So I apologize for the noise. But in all of this, she's talking about what happens to people when we are constantly bombarded by stuff we can't do anything about or think we can't do anything about. It makes us apathetic. As Jane Goodall points out, Dr. Jane, you know, apathy is the worst trait you could have as a human being. You have, if you're lucky, you have just about 28,835 days to be alive. And I think most of that time, at least it has been for me, is undoing what's been done. And what's been done to me, for the most part, was unconscious. Well-meaning parents, well-meaning people, you pick up this, you pick up that. Pretty soon you start to say, oh my gosh, I've become a different human than I thought I would be. And then you have time and opportunity to undo that. That's what Scrooge did. How Scrooge got where he is laid out in the first part, the staves, as the book is broken down into five staves. It plainly shows why he became that way. He was sent off to boarding school, people died, you know, he became this miserly guy, and he had a couple left turns in business, and next thing you know, he has become this crusty old SOB. Do you not know people like that? I do. And yet you see the glimmer of light in them every now and again, a little glimmer of hope, a little shine on them. Then it goes away because life has eroded their spirit to the point where it's easier to have the rust cover their wounds than to deal with it from the inside out. And so they remain that way, stuck in that space. And then, of course, comes the redemption. But that redemption is only through pain. Scrooge is made to go back and look at his past. Who the F wants to do that? Especially at Christmas. Who wants to go back and look at it? Look, I was talking with somebody the other day. And I, full disclosure, as much as I miss my parents at the holidays, it was a shit show for the most part. My mom was an alcoholic. My dad didn't help matters. He just pretended she wasn't. And most of my Christmases, when I was a little kid, I didn't notice it as much. But as I got older, we're not good. And so it's taken me years to forgive them for who they were, number one, because they didn't know any better. If they'd have known better, I really don't think they knew better. It was like talking to someone who's got, you know, is deaf, fell on deaf ears. And so where you can clearly stand outside of the situation, go, do you not see what's going on? And like, can't hear it, can't see it. So my references to Christmas were not always that good. The way out of that for me was Santa Claus, probably the reason I collect so many of them. The concept of Santa Claus, of this man who brings peace and joy and gifts and laughter and love, that's what I thought Christmas should be, and not this other version I was getting. And so for 20 years, I became Santa Claus. You can read about this in my second book called Every Moment Matters. I was going to read out of that, but I don't want to get windy here. I'm already, in my mind, like beating this into the ground, but it's my show, so I can. For 20 years, Santa Claus. It started when I was in the service, and as I mentioned, in Every Moment Matters, there's a chapter called The Sack Man, and it recounts that time and the experiences that I had, and they were pretty cool. And it started in 1980, 78, 79, maybe I did a couple times for local people. Then in 1980, when I was in the Coast Guard, I was stationed at Naval Air Station Glenview, which no longer exists, and I was asked to be the Santa Claus at the Christmas party. I don't know if I was actually asked. I volunteered. I think I got a day off if I did it. And while it was with a bunch of rowdy coasties, and it was one of those times where I think somebody whacked me in the head with a really big peppermint cane, and there was a little wild turkey involved in that, I was hooked. Like, once a year I can redeem myself. And again, I wasn't a bad guy. I wasn't a good guy. I was just a guy. But there was something about putting that suit on and that beard. It was like Superman to some degree. It gets contagious. And pretty soon being out among people and bringing joy to them was offsetting the stuff that I grew up with as far as Christmas. And let me be clear. You know, my folks are long gone. As I said, I've cleaned the slate with them. It allows me to talk about this stuff as plainly as possible and understand where they were at the time and the tools that they had and the ones they didn't, the ones I thought they should have because I had them and they did not. but it has allowed me the biggest part of this Christmas thing, which is forgiveness and moving forward, in my opinion. So 20 years I did that. There was this one house I went, 10, 12 years in a row, and I watched a little girl go from, you know, like a six-year-old to 16 or 17, and every year I'd go up to this house. I don't even know how I started with these people, and they would leave the toys in a bag out under the porch, and the house was lit up. It was so beautiful, and I would be in my best red and white and, you know, beard and the whole deal and the bells, and oh my gosh. And I'd take the bag and I'd walk in the front door and they were all waiting for me and there was cookies and milk and I'd stay there for about 25 minutes, half hour. The only bad part was this little shitty dog that didn't like me. When the dog passed, I felt bad, but at least he didn't try to kill me. But I did that for so many years at so many different places and there's nothing more humbling, I'm here to tell you. Tend to do breakfast with Santa at a home for kids with cancer and other illnesses. And they line up and they just want to talk to you. And they're safe with you, and they're good with you because they know who you are. And I did my best to really put the Santa gig on. I'm telling you, it was very hard for people to recognize me out of uniform, let's put it that way, and in uniform. But to have these kids who were on very borrowed time come and sit on my lap and tell me all they wanted for Christmas was to be better, or that their mom and dad would stop crying, or that those type of things. There wasn't anything about toys, it wasn't about dolls, it wasn't about money. It was about their health and about their family for the most part. And I never forget that. Every time I put these Santas up and I think about it, I put that suit on, I get what's going on here. It becomes more and more important to me to do shows like this, to say to whoever's listening, whether you're in Atlanta or Aspen, from Trinidad to Toronto, you know, from New York to Nashville, or anywhere else in the world, that Christmas to me is an opportunity for redemption and transformation. And we don't wait for somebody else to be Santa Claus. You become Santa Claus. And you don't have to put the whole suit on, but it's the spirit of the thing that I think makes all the difference. So as I finished up watching The Scrooge this morning, and you know, I know I could almost probably recite the whole movie. Some of Alistair Sims' movements and things say so much more than the words that come out of his mouth. And there's a particular scene, I'm going to run this in a little bit here to close up the show. There was two scenes, but the one in particular to me, while they're all great, is when he realizes, you know, how his life's been, and he changes it, and he sits with this woman on the steps of his home, who's been his cleaning woman, and he scares the shit out of her, basically, but he ups her pay. And because of his transformation, she transforms. He's sitting on the stairs, his hair is sticking up, and you might think I'm mad, and he does this whole thing, and it gets me every time. But to his transformation gives her an opportunity for transformation. She sees him in a different light. That's transformation. When you change, you have unconsciously given people permission to do the same. One of the other scenes is when he shows up at his sister's son's house. He's been invited many times for Christmas, never goes, and he walks in, and there's a woman there taking his coat, a young lady. And before he enters the room to get into the party, he kind of turns his head back just a little bit and looks at this young lady. And the young lady obviously knows who he is and who she thinks he is. And she gives him this little knowing nod, like, it's okay for you to go in there. And he kind of nods back. It is cinematic brilliance to me. But that acknowledgement of, look, I know who you are, and I certainly know who you've been, but it's still okay for you to move forward, gets me every time as well. And of course, the big scene for me in the movie is when he's visited by Jacob Marley. And I think that's really the theme of this show. And it's become something that is, I don't know that I'm definitely not naive, that's for sure. I don't even, not even hopeful, but maybe insistent that if we pull back from all these influences that make our life difficult, if we pull back from the things that we're arguing over the best Scrooges and stick with the messages of the things, and then go about our business to be that. Because to me, in the end, that is the message of the movie. You don't always have to be the way that you are. That there are ample opportunities in great ways and small ways. Whether he's upping the woman's pay per week or donating scads of money, or he raises Bob Cratchit's pay and becomes the best uncle to Tiny Tim and all that type of stuff, or in a small nod those things matter. And I have found that the less I stay, what is the old adage? Be in the world, but not of the world. We got to be in the world. We're here. But we don't have to be of all that stuff that's out there. And 99.9%, we can't do anything about that stuff. It's already happened. By the time you hear it on the news or watch it on the news, it's already happened. But in the next moment or two, you can do something somewhere at the supermarket checkout line, in traffic. These little things that are better energetic movers than the old ways of being. And when Scrooge transforms and literally the light shines within him again, I think that is the true meaning of all of this. And I find myself being reminded time and time and time again that you do what you can, where you are with what you have. As the great Theodore Roosevelt said, that too is the message of this thing. But in the end, the theme that I really was going for is what the ghost of Marley says, which you'll hear in just a couple of minutes, and I will say here first, is that mankind is our business. It's our business. It was just as much the business in 1844 as it is in 2021. That's not changed at all. And when I think of the different ways of reaching out to people at this time of year, even if you do it for just a couple of days, it's better than not doing it all. So the apathy doesn't swallow you up and that you find some way to do something, whether you're just dropping a little bit extra in Salvation Army or the charity of your choice, or you're helping somebody do, you know, with something they're struggling with, or you're just somebody who's bringing a little bit more light to the place. This has been an ongoing struggle for humanity since forever. And the only way that it transforms is through you and I. That's it. Can't control anybody else. You have the opportunity to go from who you are to who you want to be and who you could be, no matter what's happened to you. Look at Scrooge is the metaphor, right? So all of this kind of put into a basket. I've been anxious to run this video, which is it's kind of wonky, and I've had to work on it in production quite a bit to get it to where I think you can hear it well. But just remember that humanity and mankind, just remember that we're all on a timer here. And I have friends that were here last Christmas that will not see this Christmas. And in their memory and in their stead, I like to think that the things that I do, some are public, some are private, to help people, is also with them in mind. That mankind and womankind and childkind and humanity, that's really our business. A little later in the week, hopefully, little heads up for next episode. I'm looking for a tape, no promises, that I'm on to air next Thursday with my friend, the late, great Roby Lester Eccleston. And Roby was the voice of Mrs. Claus in some of those Rankin-Bass animations in the 1960s with Fred Astaire. Santa Claus is Coming to Town, I believe. And she was a delightful human being, on the Disney payroll person. She died many, many years ago, but she wrote a book called The $20 Christmas, which I just love. And I have tapes somewhere in the vast Aurora Media archive. And if I can find one of the shows with Roby, I think you'll really, really enjoy it. Before I close this up and give you a little bit of audio on the way out, every time I come to this microphone, I want to do something or leave something that has value. Working with people, I'm approached quite often, can you help me do a podcast? I'm saying, well, why do you want to do it? Well, everyone does podcasts. Well, first of all, everyone doesn't. That means there'd be 7 billion and they're not. So get off the generalities. Number two, I can't help you show you how to do it until you tell me why you want to do it. So we get down to the crux of what needs to take place. And I think there's a lot in the world that doesn't need to be listened to, quite frankly. What you focus on expands. And just because you can doesn't mean you should. It's like the old thing from Jurassic Park. Just because you can make dinosaurs might not be a good idea. So hopefully, and I thank you for listening all these years on this Life 2.0 podcast, especially the subscribers who have stuck with me and continue to do so, which makes it available to the world. I hope that you find value in these things as we continue on. We're well over 10,000 downloads, and I always have said I just don't want to turn the microphone on to just bloviate, speculate, and verbally defecate. I want to bring something that maybe has you tilt your head a little bit, go, huh, never thought of that. Or, huh, never thought of that. There's a difference. Anyway, here's a little bit of audio from the 1951 version of A Christmas Carol. And thanks for listening.
You want the whole day off tomorrow, I suppose. It's quite convenient, sir.
Not convenient. It's not fair. If I stop you half a crown for it, you'd think yourself ill-used, wouldn't you? But you don't think me ill-used if I pay a day's wages for no work, do you?
It is only once a year, sir. It's a poor excuse for picking men's pocket every 25th of December. I'm sure I'm very sorry, sir, to cause you such an inconvenience. It's the family more than me, sir. They put their hearts into Christmas, as it were, sir.
Yes, and put their hands into my pocket, as it were, sir. I suppose you'd better the whole day. Be back all the earlier next morning.
I will indeed, sir. Thank you, sir. It's more than generous of you, sir.
Yes, I know it is. You don't have to tell me.
Merry Christmas, sir.
Merry Christmas, sir. You, a clerk, and 15 shillings a week with a wife and a family, talking about a Merry Christmas. I'll retire to Bedlam.
Yes.
Hear me. My time is nearly gone. I come tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate. A chance and hope of my procuring Ebenezer.
Thank you, Jacob. You were always a good friend of mine.
You will be visited by three spirits.
But was that the chance of hope that you mentioned, Jacob?
It was.
In that case, never mind. I think I'd rather not have.
Without their visits, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first when the bell tolls one. You don't believe in me.
I don't.
Why do you doubt your senses?
Because a little thing affects them. A slight disorder of the stomach makes them keek. You might be an undigested bit of beef. A piece of cheese. A fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave in you. It's all humbug, I tell you.
Man of the worldly mind, do you believe in me or not?
I do. I must. But why do you walk the earth? And why do you come to me?
It is required of every man that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men. If it goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death. It is doomed to wander through the world. It cannot share, but might have shared, and turn to happiness.
Why do you fit out?
I wear the chain I forged in life. I made it link by link, and yard by yard. I girded it on of my own free will, and of my own free will. I wore it.
You have my sympathy.
You do not know the weight and length of strong chain you bear yourself. It was full as heavy and as long as this, 7 Christmas Eves ago, and you have labored on it since. It is a ponderous chain. Mark me! In life, my spirit never roved beyond the limits of our money-changing home. Now I am doomed to wander without rest or peace. Incessant torture in the grim office.
But it was only that you were a good man of business, Jacob.
Business! Mankind was my business. Their common welfare was my business. And it is at this time of the rolling year I suffer most. Hear me. My time is nearly gone. I come tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate.
I am not mad.
Don't be violent, Mr. Scrooge. So you forced me to scream for the beagle.
The beagle, madam? I think it's the beagle.
At Guinea?
hands. No, Mr. Gilmer. It's for a Christmas present.
A Christmas present? For me?
Of course, for you. A merry, merry Christmas. Dear Mrs. Dover, how much do I pay you?
2 shillings a week.
Well, 2 shillings. It's forthwith raised to 10.
10 shillings a week, here? You're sure you don't want to see a doctor?
A doctor, certainly not. Nor the undertaker. Now off you go and enjoy yourself. That's a good girl.
May, when grief and sorrow and swelling, young Jenny Crow on his deathbed lay, for love of Barbara Allen, so slowly, slowly she came up, and slowly she came by him, and all she said, well, as she came, young man, I think.
Uncle Ebenezer!
Red, is it too late to accept your invitation to dinner?
Too late? I'm delighted, delighted! My dear, look who it is!
Can you forgive a pig-headed old fool for having no eyes to see with, no ears to hear with, all these